We have a distinguished guest here from Washington, and I'd like to introduce him. I'd like to introduce Hal Quinn, who's president and CEO of the National Mining Association. The NMA is the trade association for the U.S. mining industry, and it represents our interest in Washington. And as president and CEO, he directs the association's public policy efforts before Congress, regulatory agencies, and the White House, and sets the association's strategic agenda for media relations, grassroots communications, and political involvement. Hal brings more than 20 years of experience to his position. He has represented mining interests before the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the government in a number of positions, including as NMA's executive vice president, as its senior vice president for legal and regulatory affairs, and as general counsel. In his presentation, American Mining, Raising Our Game on the Global Stage, he will explain how public policies are constraining the U.S. mining industry's ability to perform at a higher level and meet the rising global demand for minerals and metals from a new industrial revolution that is creating a global middle class. How about a warm welcome for Hal?
Thank you, Steve. Let's see how we're doing with this mobile mic here. And I'll apologize for my voice. I'm just coming from Washington. There's a lot of germs around there, none of them good. And I'm coming down with something. And I've been to this rodeo for a number of years, so I also know the perils of trying to stand between miners and their lunch buckets. So please continue to finish your lunch while I speak today. I just came from the mining wilderness of Washington, D.C., arriving here in a leading mining capital, Arizona. I've been spending actually a lot of time recently in a number of states that have a rich mining history, but of recent vintage, not so much. And my point there, meeting with elected leaders as well as business leaders, is to explain to them that returning to that history has a rich potential for future jobs, future economic prosperity for their states, not only just in terms of mining itself, but also the downstream industries that depend on mining in terms of innovation, technology, and so forth. So here we are in a major mining capital, leading producer of copper, probably $8 or some odd billion of value add or direct value. But, you know, if we go outside this room, few people in Arizona really know that their state is the home of a world-class industry, high-wage jobs, and many of those jobs are the type of jobs that many states, indeed many countries, would like to attract right now. So we're like almost like here in Arizona, it's almost like mining is a stealth industry. The value it discovers, delivers, is almost hiding in plain sight. And in some ways, that's almost a metaphor for U.S. mining nationally. But I would say that if most Americans don't realize the value that American mining and the contribution of American mining to society today, tomorrow they're going to be rudely awakened when they see what's unfolding in front of us globally. So let's just think about a few things here. We all know the demand for resources never been greater than in all our history at this time. 3/4 of the global growth, GDP, is coming from the developing economies. And some estimate by 2050, 80% of the GDP will be from those developing nations. 80%. Now, the pace and the scope of what is going on in terms of industrialization, rapid urbanization, is just completely unprecedented, and it's stunning. Consider that in the space of 25 years, China's GDP grew by a factor of 10. And it took Great Britain the better part of the 19th century to grow by a mere factor of 4. But China's only really part of the story, and everybody focuses on China. That's only one chapter of the entire story that's really unfolding in front of us. Consider that in India, it's estimated that its labor force will grow by 1 million people a month for the next 20 years. 1 million people a month for the next 20 years. And there's plenty of headroom left in this growth story. Despite the unprecedented pace of economic growth over the last decade, the energy and commodity consumption intensities of these developing countries is just a fraction of the developed world. So it's clear that resource competition will be fierce. According to a recent survey by PwC, over 70% of the CEOs in basic industries, high-tech industries, aviation, automobiles, all see minerals and metal scarcity as a major threat to their company's success. Now, if your company is located in the United States, should that be a concern? After all, we're endowed with one of the richest mineral resources in the world, estimated to be worth about $6.2 trillion. And the United States Geological Survey tells us that when it comes to key minerals and metals such as gold and silver, zinc and copper, and more, there was more left to be discovered than has been discovered to date. When it comes to energy, we stand over the single largest energy resource base in the world. Our coal resources alone contain more energy than the proven oil reserves of the Middle East, Russia, and Africa together. So let's spike a myth right now. The United States is not the Saudi Arabia of coal. Montana is the Saudi Arabia of coal. Now, when we think about this immense resource, I understand where some would say, you know, but coal is not a renewable resource. And I'll concede that point. But at the same time, when you look at the immense resources we have, for all practical purposes, it's virtually inexhaustible. So with such a rich mineral potential, why is it then our domestic mining industry supplies less than half of the mineral needs of our manufacturing base here in the United States? Why are we as a nation continuing on the 30-year path of becoming increasingly import-dependent on minerals we can actually produce here and that our industries need here? We're clearly punching below our weight. What we have here as a mining industry, our country needs, and the rest of the world we need in volumes that are unprecedented. The question is, I want to talk to you about today is, will we be able to perform to our potential? Now, part of the answer lies with us and no one else. And another part of the answer lies outside our industry, where we have less control, our control is more limited, but we still have some influence. Let's start with what we can control. That's the welfare of our people. How we manage our business starts with how we protect our people. Now, our industry is coming off 2 years of the lowest fatality injury rates in its history. Now, that may be a milestone we want to momentarily celebrate. It's certainly not one we can trust nor be satisfied with. Leading business leaders understand that success breeds complacency, and complacency breeds failure. So if zero harm is our goal, then we must acknowledge that establishing a culture of zero incidents is certainly no accident. Now, this conference reflects that core value, our industry's laser focus on sustaining our performance, opening up with a tremendous opening session, discussing training, technology, and systems all directed at our industry's core value of safety. Now, I'm not here, and I'm hardly qualified to tell you how to reach the goal of zero harm. But I will offer another tool for your consideration. Consider this my safety share for today. And that's the National Mining Association's Core Safety Framework. Core safety draws from systems deployed by other industries successfully around the globe and here in the United States to derive continuous improvement in safety performance. It is tailored specifically for mining and is designed to complement the existing systems and to assist those who lack a systems approach. we believe Core Safety can assist any company, no matter where they are on the path or the journey to zero harm. It's a product of the vision of the leadership of my association, the CEOs of the leading companies. It's been put together by some of the best safety professionals in this industry, both on the production side and the equipment side. Our leading companies at National Mining Association are all committed and are deploying it. It is already attracting interest from other industries and specific industry segments as a model and framework to look to improve and sustain their safety performance. So, mine safety is our first priority today. Let's continue to move forward to ensure that it becomes our proudest accomplishment tomorrow. Now, let me turn to some matters outside our control that will certainly influence the performance of our industry. I'll start with energy. Virtually every segment of our industry contributes in some way to our energy, our nation's energy supply chain. But for the moment, let me just focus on two pieces or links of that chain, uranium and coal. They provide together two-thirds of our baseload electricity generation. But here, when it comes to energy policy in Washington, as well as in, around the country, we see a chasm perhaps larger than the Grand Canyon between the rhetoric and reality with our public policies. Everyone talks about all the above, but few have the courage to act on it honestly. Instead, we find a mixture of state and federal initiatives that tangle us on one hand with set aside market shares for politically picked sources and suppress ones that have served our nation so well. In the case of uranium that feeds our nuclear fleet, U.S. production still only supplies about 15% of our domestic needs. But that's not because we lack the resources, but rather due to the absence of enabling policies that will allow us to unlock the value. Case in point, recently the United States Department of Interior withdrew over 1 million acres from future development, and these 1 million acres in Arizona contain some of the richest reserves of uranium in our country. Now, the scope of this mineral withdrawal is unprecedented, and it was done despite the agency's own finding that uranium mining did not pose any significant threat. Now, it's not clear to me how the government's going to square that policy circle going forward. Perhaps no other energy source has received more ink of late than coal. It dominated the presidential debates, garnered more attention than perhaps we desired from the administration, and remains a subject of unfounded speculation about its demise. So there are more than several buckets of material here that we're going to need to move to get to the truth. So let me see if I can do it in three passes for you. First, globally, coal's centrality to the world's prosperity is indisputable. It has been the fastest-growing energy resource over the last decade and is destined to surpass oil as the world's primary energy source either by next year or the year after. The remaining build-out of humanity is all coal-centric. The infrastructure behind the world's most transformative action, lifting hundreds of millions of people from poverty, requires steel, cement, and, of course, more electricity as tens of millions of more people plug into the grid. By all accounts, this will require at least another 1.2 billion tons of coal annually within 5 years. In short, the world is growing through coal. Second, in the U.S., coal faces several headwinds. They need to be acknowledged. A slow economic recovery, unsustainably low natural gas prices, and bad public policy. The first two will self-correct. Let me make it clear the coal industry does not fear competition from other fuels. What we rightfully have a deep concern with are policies that don't allow us to compete. Let's take, for example, recent EPA actions. They set standards for coal power plants that are set purposefully beyond the reach of the best available technology today. Instead, they require technology that will not be available, and EPA acknowledges will not be available for at least a decade. Now, EPA claims this will not affect the reliability or the cost of electricity. They insist that no new coal plants will be built anyway due to low natural gas prices. and that low natural gas prices are also the driver behind the rapid retirement of so many coal-fired power plants in the United States. Unfortunately, for all Americans, they are wrong on both counts. Even an independent study released recently by Duke University, Nicholas School of Environment and Institute, no big fan of coal, shows exactly what we informed the EPA administrator 2 years ago. Only 9% of the U.S. coal fleet is economically challenged by low natural gas prices. And most of the plant retirements are the result of EPA rules. Now, there is a path to improving environmental performance at less cost and risk to our economic success if EPA would align its policies with the technology's capabilities. This industry has a track record that validates that. Over the last 30 years, coal consumption for electricity has increased by 170%. The emissions from coal per megawatt hour of electricity produced has dropped by over 90% at the same time. Third, coal's future. U.S. coal will stabilize and rebound over the next several years, despite the loss of what we see as perhaps as much as 20% of the coal-fired fleet here in the United States. By 2020, coal generation will actually recover and increase by 15% from the 2012 lows. And the reason being, the remaining coal plants will be larger on average. Most of them will be over 500 megawatts or more. They'll be more efficient, and they will run at higher capacity factors. And they will return to the pre-recession levels over 72%, which means more coal burn. Potentially, our analysis shows that we see at least 100 million tons of coal returning to the utility market during the same time frame. And, of course, the outlook for U.S. coal exports remains very bright. Last year, we shipped 125 million tons overseas. That's double the amount shipped in 2008. And with the build-out of new port capacity that's ongoing as we speak, we have the capability to double that once again. Now, later this week, the National Mining Association will be releasing a study we've commissioned with Ernst & Young to document the value to the economy of U.S. coal exports. And it will show that U.S. coal exports at present levels add $16 billion to the economy. $14 billion of that reduces our balance of trade deficit. It's the only positive, net positive addition to the U.S. balance of trade for the energy sector in the United States. And that for every million tons of coal shipped overseas, supports or creates about 1,300 jobs. So as we see the resistance being mounted in the Northwest to greater infrastructure build out up there to give the world access to our Powder River Basin and other Western coal resources, I think we need to remind our detractors that not only they're denying prosperity here back home in the United States, as well as the future exit ramp from poverty of people overseas as well. Well, let me turn to metals and minerals sector. There, I think the obstacles that stand in the way of our performing to our potential are different, but the outcomes and the results could be quite similar. Our energy policy might be characterized as a product of misunderstanding and mischief. I would say minerals policy here in the United States is a product of a lack of understanding and just plain neglect. And the danger of that neglect is fairly clear upon considering the fact that the mineral sector here, mining mineral sector, is responsible for supplying the materials that are transformed into products that account for 15% of our GDP. And as minerals resource competition becomes fiercer, unfortunately, our nation continues to place more mineral lands off limits. It makes it more difficult to obtain the permits and authorizations necessary to explore and develop our nation's mineral wealth. Now consider that the following factors. Half the public lands where much of our resource lies remains either off limits or highly restricted for mining. unless we continue to empower our agencies to withdraw more lands with very minimal consideration of what that means to our nation's future mineral needs. And while we're blessed with a world-class mineral resource base, we are cursed with a third-world permitting system. We have the dubious distinction of being second to none when it comes to having the most inefficient and protracted process that is fraught with duplication, overlap, and lack of accountability. And to make matters worse, we now have agencies claiming that even after you negotiate through that maze, agencies like the EPA claim they have the power now to retroactively revoke your permits if they determine their predecessors were unwise in granting it in the first place. At the same time now, EPA is even taking another step and saying it has the power to actually preempt states from considering whether they can issue any authorizations for new mines, as we see currently ongoing up at, on the Pebble Mine situation up in Alaska. Now, many of our policymakers cannot seem to make the connection between the upstream part of our business and the downstream industries that depend on it. They see immobile resources in the ground, but fail to understand that mining capital is quite mobile. It's hardly coincidental that as our challenges with access and permitting grow, so does our increasing import dependence on key minerals and a deterioration in the exploration of investments that serves as the future mining project pipeline. The lack of urgency here in the United States stands in sharp contrast with that in other mineral-rich nations. Let's take Canada and Australia, for example, two nations that fully understand that an efficient regulatory regime can provide a competitive advantage in the global competition for mining investment. Both countries already have relatively efficient permitting systems. They've demonstrated their eagerness to stay out front and on top. Canada recently enacted reforms called One Project, One Review to reduce the overlap between the provincial and national governments, something we've been proposing here for years in the United States. Australia has already where you can get a permit in 2 years or so, has already established a commission recently to seek even further streamlining. They came to the National Mining Association, several representatives, to ask for our ideas. We pulled out of the shelf the ones we've been trying to get our own government to adopt for well over a decade. When they told us they were about to go over and visit certain agencies such as EPA, Department of Interior, we cautioned them. We said, only go over there if you want to find out what the worst practices are and the warning not what not to do. In any event, these are just two of many countries that are preparing themselves to meet the challenges of the new global reality, one where demand will soar and supplies will become increasingly difficult to obtain. Now, these are just a few of the more troublesome examples of the public policy that's not aligned with our industry's potential or our national interest. There are others where we would hope their more thoughtful consideration would be given by our elected representatives. But I believe, despite the current state of affairs, that we've actually made some progress. Yes, slow and hopefully steady in improving some of the policy outlines here in our country. We've had some recent good success in the courts, setting aside some of the more egregious policies that impede our performance. And those victories have given the administration some pause that I hope they will use wisely to rethink their approach to both energy and mineral policies in this country. We've also been successful in securing some introduction of legislation to correct some of these bad policies before they lead to even worse outcomes and consequences. We're raising awareness among our allied industries about how their success depends on our success. And we're also seeing a new generation of elected leaders, 95 in the last two elections, come to office who are showing a much deeper appreciation and understanding and connecting the dots between our industry and the success of our country. So recently, just last week, the House Natural Resources Committee reported legislation to streamline the permitting system for mineral mines. That legislation incorporates the best practices for coordination among state and federal agencies, reduces duplication, and inserts some accountability into the process. Now, when I was testifying on that legislation, a month ago, representatives of the Department of the Interior and other government federal agencies indicated that they were not in favor of it because it would actually undercut current environmental laws. When I was asked the question, what was my response? I said, well, maybe they may want to take the time to read the legislation first. It does no such thing. It doesn't amend any particular environmental law in terms of environmental standards. What it does do, it ensures that all valid concerns about environmental protection are fully considered and addressed. Excuse me. At the same time, though, and as I told the committee, it does not allow those concerns to serve as an excuse to trap mining projects in a limbo of duplicative, unpredictable, and endless review without a decision point. Our system needs accountability, and it needs an end point where the agencies actually have to make a decision rather than putting us off forever. They need to understand that delay destroys the net present value of these projects. Time is money, and the reason why capital goes other places has a large part to do with one of the most significant risks in this country, and it's one that they pose, which is the regulatory uncertainty and permit delays. Now, we were successful in having similar legislation passed last year in the House of Representatives. Again, this version of legislation, which we think is actually even more improved, I believe will pass in a bipartisan basis once again in the House of Representatives. The future lies in the Senate, where the pathway is less clear, and where for many issues in this country, there seems to be quite a bit of gridlock, given the tight margins between Republicans and Democrats. But this is not a partisan issue. This is one where everybody, if they're honest and want to look at the legislation itself, should stand up and say, this is good for everybody. So we're hoping to convince the leadership in the Senate that this legislation deserves prompt attention. Now, as we just talked about, the world is becoming a more competitive place, and resource competition is front and center. We're facing new rivals for the first time that will challenge our economic supremacy. There's no doubt, in my mind, that American mining is adequate to the task if we find a willing partner with our government and with to create enabling policies rather than keeping in place disabling ones. Our challenges keep growing awareness for the basic fact that for our nation to succeed, our mining industry needs to be successful. So as you can see, our policy ratios are quite steep. We have a lot of material to move to get the right policy answers that will enable us to perform to our potential. So I believe I'm in the right place today. I'll need your shovels, your trucks, your dozers, and a lot of belt line to help me move a lot of that material out of Washington so we can get to the right answers. So hopefully you can return in 2 years, return your equipment, and tell you that America is a lot better place where you can sell a lot more of that equipment in the future. Thank you very much for your attention this afternoon.
Hal has agreed to take a few questions. Does anybody have any questions? I have one for you. Can you kind of describe what it's like in Washington right now? Is the NMA outgunned as far as competing with environmental NGOs that are misinformed but really well funded?
Well, I think I will say that in terms of the amount of resources we have compared to a lot of opponents to mining, the leverage there, it's pretty steep there in terms of the differential. But I think we have a team in Washington that punches well above its weight. And I think we've been able to show that value continuously. When you characterize these groups as being well-funded, they are. When you characterize them as being
uninformed.
They are not. They are fully informed, these groups, and what their business is to misinform and put out a different view of what they believe the future should be for this country. But in doing so, their formula is to tear down things, not to build things, is the way I characterize them. Whatever it's any industry that they believe is a threat to their vision, whether it's a resource industry, it could be metals, coal, oil, gas, agriculture, whatever, there's a set of views there that where they're constantly critiquing the agencies and driving them to a place where they're less competitive in the marketplace.
Okay, well, thank you, Hal. Thanks for making the trip out and bringing us up to speed. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.